We're live on the Commercial Real Estate Playbook. Frank, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Your audio is a little sketch today, Plum, because you're in Northern Michigan, but I'm still happy to see you. We also got a special guest here today, Corey Sylvester, big personality on real estate Twitter, real estate developer, tech entrepreneur. There's a lot of things that are interesting about you, but we're happy to have you on. Corey, how you doing?
Fellas, it's great to be here. Appreciate you having me on.
Okay. Yeah. Before we get into anything else, let's do, I want a quick summary of who you are. One paragraph or less. Who's Corey?
Started, born and raised in Colorado, and moved out to, Newark when I went to college, wanted to make money as basically my only objective. So went to, JP Morgan, spent about 8 years there, doing a variety of buy side, equity investing, macro research, trading, mortgage securities, and then end up, heading out to a tech hedge fund where then out of that basically spun up Union Real Time with a couple different, partners where the original idea was to, advise clients on big themes that we found. And the first theme that we found in 2015, 2016 was a massive short in the self-storage space. Like there, no one had developed storage in a while. All of a sudden people were a lot of developing. And so like shorting the REITs was the idea. So we started tracking rates because of that. And anyways, we can get into it later, but essentially from there, I never looked back and I've been in self-storage ever since. Not shorting it anymore, but actually investing and building in it.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're doing the opposite of shorting. It seems like you're actually adding supply. Was the reason you were so short on storage in 2016? You said something about supply.
Yeah, it's a good question. So from like 2009 to 2014, you know, if you don't add supply to a sector, but you continue to see demand grow, which is what's been happening in self-storage, fundamentals continue to get better and better and better. And that was what was happening in storage. And if you look at the NOI revenue rate growth from that period, like they had a very slight blip in 2009 and like just kept growing at a pretty fast mid to high single digit clip. And so what happened with the REIT stocks is they all had this massive run because, you know, life, what Uncle Bob's back in the day, Extra Space Public, they're all a beneficiary of that. And the problem with stocks is that, you know, the sell side, the guys that are recommending to buy or sell stocks, they're the last ones to really catch on, generally speaking, to like what's going to happen. And so their expectations of the future were up and to the right. Like this is just going to keep happening. And when we did a bunch of expert network calls, which is like, you know, these guys would go out and source these developers, and we were having these calls with developers, and they're like, yeah, we're building 2 million square feet in Denver. We're doing all this. We were adding it up. We're like, this is a fucking massive amount of supply. And if this all hits the next 18, 24 months, like, you know, this is going to be a big impact to the market. Now we were used to, me and my other partner on the Union Real Time, we're used to investing in technology stocks where it's like if Apple cuts your price by 20%, like your stock goes from 80 to 2. So we had expectations of like, yeah, the margins on self-storage looked a little different. But the idea was is that with all the supply coming on relative to what the sell side thought was going to happen, like there was a big difference between what we thought and what the sell side thought. And so we thought, okay, that's a great first thesis to inform people on. So let's start tracking all the rates on a daily basis, because if we did that, ultimately that's where the proof would occur. And so, you know, the business went from zero to seven figures by advising, you know, we had some of the biggest hedge funds in the industry from our contacts and people that believed in us that helped us get in front of those hedge funds. And that's how we got started, is by getting in front of people and saying, listen, storage is a great business, but the expectation of the sector is not that you're about to have this massive wave of supply. Our expectation is that you're going to have this massive wave of supply. And, you know, that's the view that we took. And ultimately we never shorted it, but essentially the advisory fees that people paid us, that's what created the foundation for us to invest in Radius Plus, because the reason Radius Plus came to be is like, okay, we knew there was 2 million square feet being built in Denver, but, and I don't know if that was a real number, but we were looking around and be like, okay, so what's the existing supply base in Denver? And, you know, there was the Self-Storage Almanac, which was essentially a collection of estimates that they would send out every year. And everyone would say, I think this is how many stores are in Denver. And I think this is the average size of them. And when we looked at that kind of data hole, we realized that that not only impacted our analysis, but it impacts developers that have to manually look up a 3-mile trade area every time they want to analyze a site. And so from that, we basically thought through, okay, if we could solve that supply data issue, which was just that you have this fragmented data set, and you need to have a kind of a unique architecture to put that together in a closed loop fashion, in a clean fashion, deduplicate it all. I mean, it's just like, it was just a massive problem. It's like, how can you create tools that allow you to be so efficient to take what would have been 1 billion hours and turn it into, you know, 5,000 hours. And so that's what we did. You know, we pivoted and that was the first data set that we really started building on and, you know, started selling Radius Plus subscriptions and, you know, came down to like 1 or 2 months. And if we didn't start selling, we were going to be out of money. So we cut it pretty close, but.
Yeah. So you, it's crazy. Did you, when you were advising hedge funds, was this thesis your own, or did like someone be like, hey, Corey, go take a look at REITs for me for storage, or was this your hypothesis?
I had I was talking to another hedge fund while I was at the hedge fund I was at, and they were like, I was interested in going to this other hedge fund. And they said, well, you know, someone sent me something about the self-storage industry. Can you take a look? I don't know what's going on. Someone said that there may be some development going on in self-storage. Do you think there's anything here? So that was put on my lap. From there, the thesis we developed, and they actually hired me to advise them on it. And I would say that we developed the thesis around it, and we developed the research around it. But no, someone asked me like, hey, what's going on in self-storage? And that was where we started, you know, peeling back the onion and being like, wow, this is, you know, up until that point, I'd never done anything in real estate before. So, you know, it was all new to me.
Yeah. It's interesting that that single event triggered so many other things in the future. That's what's interesting about it to me, you know? Funding the research, how are you funded? I know it sounds like from the start, some hedge funds were paying you guys, but when did it actually become Radius, and how did you get the money for that?
So the hedge funds were paying us like $30,000 a month. I mean, it was like some big ticket numbers. And so we had, I think at our peak, you know, 20, 25 hedge funds that were paying us for this thesis. So we were making a lot more money than we were. I mean, we weren't spending it. Mm-hmm. We were realizing that, you know, we had to continue to exist. So we were putting in the bank. So basically it was like the excess that we made from that initial venture. And there was a tail to it as well, right? It didn't just all end one day.
Yeah.
Kind of bridge the gap for us to then, all right, we're going to spend a lot of dollars and man hours sitting in an office and making polygons around self-storage buildings and deduplicating the supply base and building the infrastructure for Radius. And I think the first time I went was in 2000 and quite frankly, I think it was in 2017 in the January of 2017 or 18, I went to there's like a self-storage association winter conference and it was in Telluride. And I went up to the Extra Space CEO and I was like, this is what we're doing. I want to put in front of your team, like, how can I do it? And he was awesome. He put it in front of his team. And that was kind of the beginning of like getting a flavor of like, are there legs here? Actually, you know what? it was a conference I went to. We sat in front of Dean Jernigan. You remember Herbert Dean Jernigan, Jernigan Capital?
No, you should explain who he is.
He was the former CEO of CubeSmart. So he was involved in like the creation of CubeSmart. He ran GE's capital portfolio. Storage USA is the legacy portfolio. And he saw the platform we had created to track rates for the hedge funds. And he's like, go talk to my team, because like, there's something here. I want to see if there's anything that we can do together. And it was when they walked us through their process of like how they look at development sites. Cause what Jernigan Capital did, they were capital that they used to give to developers. And then they invested in their development sites. Like that was the sole model of Jernigan Capital. So their business was evaluating self-storage sites. And so they walked us through like how they evaluate a site, the process for doing it. Like they have to Google self-storage and like find where every facility is and then draw the buildings and then figure out how many stories each of those buildings are. And, you know, it was just a very tedious process, and they throw out that analysis at the end. They'd have to, you know, also add in the demographics and try and append the rates to that analysis. And it was like, when we saw that analysis, that was the first time we were like, okay, we can digitize supply. We can add in rates, we can add in demographics, and we can combine it into a single platform. And the scary part about that is that no one wanted to buy it until you basically had mapped the entire country.
Mm.
And that took like almost 2 years. So like, you're building something where you're like, yeah, I think this is going to work, but no one had ever bought this type of product before. So we had no idea. So we were like heading full steam into a brick wall. We were like, I think that wall is not very thick, so we're just going to plow straight through it. But.
And was there a point when the money from like your advisory fees stopped coming in and you're 100% dedicated to essentially building it for the REITs or these funds, but they're not really committed to you? Like, did they pledge any capital? Like, or were you guys just out into the void, like just building this thing?
Completely in the void.
Yeah, it's scary.
No one was like, hey, we'll advance, buy this thing.
Yeah, that's scary.
No one was. I mean, my partner wanted to try and pre-sell it and see if we could, but you know, the model, we went to the first SSA show. I'm trying to remember when that was, 2018 maybe. And we were like trying to get people to sign up for annual subscriptions to regions. And the feedback we got at the show was, hey, I love this product, but I don't have the money to pay you like $5,000 for the San Antonio region or the Atlanta region. And one of my other partners, to his credit, was just like, listen, we got to do a pay-per-use platform. And that's where the Radius Credits thing came in. Mm-hmm. And I was adamantly against it, because I was like, first of all, we'd spent the last like 2 years, like at the end of it, my partner had a wrist brace because he had tendonitis in his wrist from so much mousing of actually drawing these things. But I felt like we were giving away so much value, and I was so wrong, because what we were doing is we were taking what was a very fragmented network and we were opening it up so that everyone had access to this information. And naturally, people that wanted the enterprise contract or the bigger dollar value contract, they progressed to the enterprise side. But what it did, it created this amazing network of now, you know, at any given point, there's 1,300 people scrounging around on Radius Plus, and they're putting projects into the system that otherwise no one would know about. Mm-hmm. And it creates this network effect of data. And, you know, that was how we kind of transitioned from a traditional like enterprise only model, very restricted, to like very open, kind of the product you see today. But in the summer of 2019, this is like a long-winded way of answering your question, we were essentially running out of money.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when I started getting some larger enterprise contracts. It came down to like 2 month period where it's like, if we didn't do it, like we were just out of money.
Yeah.
And you know, I had some great friends in the industry now. You know, one of the guys was at Crow Holdings, which was big in the space. We started landing some larger contracts for some of the larger institutions, and we scraped by just barely, and it just kept growing. So, you know, today we don't run in that stock advisory. I mean, we got exited the stock advisory in like 2018 or 2000. Yeah, I think 2018. So it didn't last that long, but it was a dramatic transition.
Yeah, that's scary, man. That's a cool story to be not funded and to come that close to running out of cash. Because then, was it even an option to you and your partner to be like, hey, you got to put in X amount of dollars, or we both do? Or was it
the way that we were?
Or was it gonna be?
I didn't have the money. I didn't have the money. We'd taken these skimpy salaries for the last 3 years, and I'd been at JP Morgan, but you know, for a variety of reasons, like I didn't have the balance sheet to sustain myself. Like the risk I was taking by going off and doing this was when I look back on it, was crazy, because I didn't have the financial wherewithal to like see it through for a very long time.
Yeah. And you left good high paying jobs.
Which in my mind, I was always like, I can go back there. But, you know, in my mind, like I'd spent enough time at those jobs with the spreadsheet of like what my net worth would be and how long it would take to get there on the path I was on. And I was like, I couldn't, it was basically like, I just had to give up my career in order to get where I wanted to be. Like this was going to take 25 years. And I was like, I'd rather risk on doing something else than being locked in here. But yeah, I took a $100,000 salary for 3 years, which, you know, living in wealthy suburbs of Connecticut, like doesn't last.
Yeah, you got kids. So it's there's no childcare.
When I quit to start with Union Real Time, which was kind of the parent company of Radius, I just had my first son. Mm-hmm. And you know, needless to say, like I got pretty good at managing credit card balance transfers.
Oh, wow.
Because
yeah, dude,
that's the world I had to live in. But I was fine taking that risk, because the alternative of taking the train into New York City 5 days a week, this is before the pandemic, being in a suit and like selling financial products that I just didn't believe in, was just not an option as far as like how I wanted to live the rest of my life. Like I'd rather just go down in flames and figure something else out.
Yeah. What's the math equation? Someone once said, they said risk times effort equals confidence. And I think there's something there, you know, like being decisive about taking your own risk. You're like, okay, I feel good about that. Something to be said.
I've always been a big risk taker though. Yeah. So it's like, you know, my wife says that sometimes I take too big of risks, but I don't know. It seems to, on a net basis, you can get burned, but at the same time, like, and I don't take the same risks anymore because obviously I have a different, you know, position moat to protect.
Right.
Yeah. But risk taking when you're young, like that's what I tell people when they're asking me, like, what should I do? How should I get it? It's like, I don't know what's going on in your world, but take a lot of risk.
Yeah, I agree. I wish I took more. I'm 30. Actually, I turned 36 yesterday. I wish I took more.
Well, you're still young.
Still young. But I wish I took more. I think most people in their 30s do. I do want to ask you before we move on from Radius, what is your current position in Radius? Like, has that went full cycle for you? What's your current role in that company?
We've got a great team set up at Radius. So it's like, I don't have to handle a lot of, I mean, business development, things of that nature are handled by people. I'm looking over like, issues as it relates to existing clients or, you know, things that come up. So we're kind of overseeing what's a really solid team that's executing on the Radius side. So I don't have to do much. We're thinking about, you know, where we're going. We're building another company called Managed Space, which is property management software. So, you know, we've been spending a lot of time on that. I'm investing a lot of resources in that. And that's coming to market, you know, shortly. So my time will be spent more in that element of it than than anything on the Radius side, because that's pretty much taken care of with some existing resources that just crush it.
Yeah, stable. Very, very cool, man. Very awesome. So now, what are you currently working on? I know the answer, but I think our viewers be interested because it's a little bit different than software.
Yeah, well, we got in. I got into real estate. So the idea was that, you know, what Radius was using technology to, you know, make a process more efficient. If we think about like Radius in its most raw form, it's not a AI algorithm, you know, correlation based analysis. It's how can we take a process that otherwise would take people 10 hours and turn it into 30 seconds of analysis. The seat I sat in at Radius gave me this perspective of, okay, this is how a developer works. This is how they think. It was very much focused around like square feet per capita, and this is how we should analyze the market. And having come from, you know, the buy side on the equity business, you know, what we were good at doing that. And the reason why is we kind of boiled things down to their most like fundamental baseline drivers, like what really drives this business. And when you look at what drives the business in storage, it's rental rates, right? Mm-hmm. Everything revolves around what rate you're getting, what rate you're increasing and by. And that's kind of a more fundamental factor than how many square feet of storage are in a market relative to the population. So when we use that as like our baseline framework, we came up with some processes to where we could find sites and analyze the market in a way using that as kind of the core tenet to be much more efficient at finding out like where should you be building. Mm-hmm. And on the Radius side, we showed that technology and that concept to a lot of the developers out there, because we were like, well, let's just license this and sell this concept to the developers. They loved it, but we couldn't clear the market on like what the price really looked like. And in my mind, I was like, instead of, you know, coming to some sort of lowball offer, I'll just go prove that we can be more efficient in finding sites. And I called a guy named Drew Dolan, who was one of my clients on the Radius side. He was running a private equity firm that had built six self-storage assets. I talked to him about the concept. And in March of 2020, we launched what's now DXD Capital. And the original concept was, let's go out, let's raise a first discretionary fund. Let's see if we can build 10 assets on the back of this concept. And so we raised, you know, the short story is we raised $53 million, ended up doing a sidecar and raising $63 million and building 10 assets from that fund. Three are open, seven under construction. We raised a second GP fund at $35 million, which means that instead of being 100% of the equity of all the deals that we're doing now, we're 10% of it. And then we syndicate the remaining 90%. Mm-hmm. We went that route just because at the scale that we've been trying to achieve, like it was beyond our capability to try and raise like a $250 million fully discretionary fund. It was just like way beyond what our capabilities were at the time. And yeah, so we've got another 15 or so behind the original 10 and, you know, just building a lot of storage from, you know, we've got one in Honolulu, one in Maui, we've got in Rhode Island, Atlanta, Miami, everywhere. We're building a lot of storage.
There's so many questions that could come off the heels of that because it's a lot. I'll start with find. So how are you finding or making site selections? Take me through like a little bit of your process there.
It all comes down to when you think about like how to analyze self-storage, it's a pretty basic model. You've got your land cost, you've got your building cost, you've got your property taxes. And then you've got your site, which is basically like once you understand, you've got your revenue, which is rental rates, property taxes, building cost, land cost. And from there, you know, you can make the model work only a certain number of ways, right? So in any given area, you know generally what you're going to pay for land. Unless you're doing a basement or some sort of unique structure, you know what your building costs are. Property taxes, you generally have an understanding for. And so you're solving for like, what rate do I need to make this work? Right. And so that's how we come to the analysis with it, which is like how do I identify those areas that have the rate that's of the level we need in order to make it worth our time? And so whether it be stuff that comes on the market, we're very quickly using our technology to like sift through like what rate we should get rid of. And then what sites and what areas that have rate that are at a certain level that we should pursue. And that's the like the base fundamental, right? It's like getting rid of how many square feet of storage are there relative to the population. You know, there's a million reasons why that doesn't work. It like, and at the end of the day, if you have low square feet per capita, but your rate sucks, and you have high square feet per capita, but you got great rate, that's actually better because you're adding much smaller amount of supply in a high square feet per capita market with high rates. And so,
it's like, it's a lower percentage of existing supply, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's like you'd rather be in that position than adding 30% to a new market. You'd rather add 7% to a new market because incrementally each facility is giving you fewer of its existing customers. If you were to say that no new customers are coming onto the market.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And different customer bases, they don't all act the same, right? Someone we own in military towns behaves very, very different than a tourist town. They're just very, very different. University is the same thing. So I agree.
Exactly. So exactly. And there are different characteristics, structural characteristics as to why certain towns have a structurally higher square feet per capita than others. In the Northeast, you got a lot of basements.
Yeah.
Structurally is a lot lower square feet per capita than in Houston, where you don't build any basements.
Yeah. And in Texas, they don't have a lot of attics either, right? So it's just straight 3-2. Most homes are 1,400.
And even within like those regions, some areas have a much higher propensity of using storage than others. So it's like, I don't know. It's a much more complicated answer than I understand why historically people use square feet per capita, because there's like a very understandable metric. Mm-hmm. I could estimate the square feet of storage and I can estimate population. Obviously, perhaps hypothetically, there should be some balance there. But I think when we, you know, having access to pricing data that's essentially repricing every single day, like that's giving us a much better signal than anything than we've ever been able to get on the on any other method.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. The funding side of your business, is it institutional? That first 50, the 63 million you raised first, is that mostly institutional capital from your previous work, or how did you come up with that cash?
That's largely almost entirely due to my partner Drew. Mm-hmm. You know, he'd spent 20 years at a firm named Titan Development and developed some pretty amazing relationships. And so during the pandemic, to answer your question, it's mostly high net worth and some small family offices and a couple of small institutions. We spent, you know, we hit the road in August of 2020, which was a wild time to be crossing the country. You know, I was flying to New Mexico, taking two connections just to get there because everything was shut down, because that's where Drew's at and a lot of the high net worth individuals are at. It was sitting in front of these high net worth, you know, investors and telling them our story. Like, this is how I got in storage. This is why we think about it differently. This is how we think about analyzing sites. You know, the industry itself, this is why, you know, you've gone from 7% of the population using it to 11%. You know, it's a 50% demand increase. Do we think it stops here? No. Do we know if it goes to 30? I don't know. That's kind of the unknowable aspect of like self-storage demand, is like, at what point does penetration peak out? I'm not quite sure. So you've got this like great story. And then Drew has this background of execution and trust he's built up with all these clients. And, you know, the factor that they had to trust us on was that Drew and I could work together.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big risk. I don't know if they knew they were taking the magnitude of that risk. And, but Drew and I were both on the same page that we felt like we could trust each other. And I've always been a, you know, like I said, a high risk taker, but I, you know, you interact with people, you have discussions with people, you get a sense of who they are pretty quickly. And, you know, people can hide that and deceive you. And it's not to say I haven't been wrong plenty of times, but he, you know, in developing a relationship over the 3 years I knew him, that was a risk I was willing to take. And, luckily, the investors took that risk with us. And so in that first November of 2020, right after the election, we had our first close at like $13 million because there was the election as well. It wasn't just COVID. It was like people were scared about COVID. People were scared about the election. The good thing with what was going on in that period is like storage rates, as you know, were skyrocketing.
Yeah, stimulus.
Yeah. Like yeah, that was occurring. Nice. That was like the one thing I have to say, like we just had incredibly lucky timing is that the backdrop of what was happening in storage was phenomenal. Like you'd mm-hmm. never had a period where we're heading into the winter slow season and rates continue to go up. Like that's a pretty good story to be able to tell people.
Yeah.
But they were worried about, you know, Trump versus Biden. And COVID and all this other stuff. And so once the election was behind us, we started to gain some momentum. And by the next spring, we were essentially at 50. You know, a lot of conversations and flights and meetings to get there. But, you know, once we got a certain traction, you know, we got there.
Yeah. There's a level of execution and kind of catching lightning in a bottle, you know, so you have no choice but to put your foot in the gas. That's all you can do, right? It's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. It was quite a risk, but you know, we got lucky on a lot of regards, but at the same time, like we were leveraging, you know, my partner Drew, he's a grinder. And that's kind of the one characteristic we both share is that we're not in this exceptional in any given field other than we just work really hard. And we were on the plane a lot.
Yeah.
Meeting with a lot of different people, and luckily it worked out.
That's cool. And how'd you meet your partner? And before you answer, it sounds like you're kind of the business case visionary in this ordeal or this whole system. And he came in with the operational chops, and you guys kind of met in the middle on fundraising. Is that the dynamic that exists?
Yeah, generally speaking, I'd say that's a fair way to characterize it. I mean, we met with a coach that he'd known for a long time. Within like, you know, a couple hours, he's like, yeah, so people shouldn't report to you. He's talking about me. He's like, you're kind of leading the business and thinking about like what's next. And that's true. I think I've developed better ability because I do still lead the development side of like the site selection and things of that nature. But like once it moves into construction and like entitlement and things of that nature, like Drew has helped us build out that element of the business and understands that. I mean, he has years and years of background doing that. So when it comes to that, like that's where he's stepping in and really knows, you know, things that have gone wrong and how to think about what we should be looking for and things of that nature. That's where he's crushed it for us. But yeah, he's definitely, you know, the one that's been through this and has figured out how to construct the team. Cause he at Titan, which was a private equity firm, you know, they ran a fund before. So like he knew operationally what we needed to do, what needed to set up, how accounting needed to work, what we needed in a CFO. If I tried to do that by myself, which originally before Drew, I was trying to put some deals together with this process. And like, I was just looking back, I was biting off way too much because you need somebody that you can't learn that stuff on the fly. While you're trying to do everything else, really. I mean, you need somebody that knows what they're doing because you can blow yourself up.
Yeah. I don't know anyone that went out on their own on development for like multi-story class A stuff. Like everyone who bites their teeth on their own, it's like tertiary class B. I don't know anyone that did that. So I agree.
Yeah.
So we covered like, hey, how was storage in 2020 and 21? We covered your fund. What about now? I view storage as in a much different place in terms of pricing, rates, than it was a year ago? It's market to market for sure, but in general, how are things changing in your opinion, and how is that affecting your business?
Yeah, if you look at a chart of rates since 2016 when we started tracking them, rates are still above where they were at their peak in 2016. But they're off 20 to 25% from the peak of COVID, which is, the true peak of COVID was 2021. Year over year was kind of flat to down single digit in 2022, generally speaking. And this year it's been down like 20, 25%. That's the headline people have been reading with storage, which it's true. Rates are down, rental rates. The way I think about it is that the incremental demand we got from COVID, the number of people that were, had pulled forward their demand for renting renovating a home or moving their stuff out of their extra bedroom for a home office or for a gym, like that temporary, I wouldn't call it temporary, but that demand that kind of was created by COVID is not there anymore. So obviously, with how tight the system was, like you remove that demand and the incremental price for storage falls. We haven't fallen back to where we were pre-COVID. So in my mind, there are still a lot of those people that are still there. If you look at move in, move out data on a year-over-year basis, we're still pretty stable. We are stable. So I think about us as being like, okay, it's going to be a grind from here. The headlines are that pricing's down 20% year-over-year, but we're coming off of rates being up 40, 50%. So storage is in a healthy spot from the standpoint of demand situation. That's the way I think about storage today. The acquisition and development markets, I mean, you're very well versed in what's going on in acquisitions. Like the expectation of sellers may be abating a bit, but you've gone from the last 5, 6, 7 years of like one of the hottest in-demand asset classes, for Huber and everyone else that's getting into it, of like, holy shit, you can buy this thing, raise rents, do some common sense business restructuring and make a ton of money. Like that's inflated the expectations of sellers, which now that interest rates are where they are and rental rates have come back down and people can't buy a deal with negative leverage under the hopes that you have cap rate compression anymore. Like that's not a scalable process. So like on the acquisition side, sellers are coming back down to earth. I think there's still a big spread there because I think they think, well, interest rates are going to come back down, so you should be paying me a 4 cap. And buyers are like, I'm getting 6% debt on this acquisition. I can't pay you a 4 cap because there's negative leverage embedded in that. So there's not a lot of transactions that are occurring 2023. And you could probably talk more of that in your markets that you're seeing. On the development side, like yields have come down. Yield on cost has definitely come down. We are still finding opportunities. They're lower returning opportunities than they were 2 years ago, because construction prices are up, land prices are starting to come down for us, but rates are down 20% from they were at the peak. So, everything is as tight as can be. And the bigger factor for us is not like, okay, we've got a 20% gross IRR in this deal. It's that the cost of financing, both from an interest rate, but also banks have had a run on their deposits in the last 6 months. The Fed is increasing capital requirements for a lot of institutions. And depending upon what bank you are, you may have some problem commercial real estate, not in storage, but maybe it's in office or in some other real estate sectors, which is further constraining your balance sheet. So you've got lenders that are in a position that, they're having issues outside of just higher interest rates that's constraining their ability to lend. So all those things being equal, being contributing factors, like development's really tough right now. It's really tough. We're finding ways to continue to make it work, and to get deals done. Because if you think about on the backside of this, in the next 18, 24, 36 months, there's not going to be a lot of new supply that's delivered for obvious reasons. So if you can find those markets where you want to be, the view is that you're going to be delivering into a pretty healthy market.
Yeah. And this dynamic, it's not like a bloodbath out there, right? But this dynamic reminds me of why people say, when people are like, if I was back in 2010, I would go and buy everything. And we're starting to see, I think, why that doesn't happen, right? I'll give an example. We were underwriting a deal outside of Tampa, and it was a good deal. 2020 standards, amazing deal. Go in at like a 6.5 cap, stabilize at 8.5, right? But with today's assumptions, my IRR is like 12. I'm like, 3 years ago, my IRR is like an 18 or 19, you know, because there's like this, when things go down, there's like this beta that you can't put in the Excel sheet, but it likely is going to happen. Mm-hmm. And that's why the deals don't get done. Part of it's lagging seller expectations, but it's also the skepticism of the whole system. You know what I'm saying? It's like this weird,
is there an exit cap assumption around?
Okay, yeah. Our exit cap assumptions are higher. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Buying it at 6.5 today and you think you can expand it to 8.5, is your exit then still 6.5?
Right. We like, just to maintain credibility, this was an industrial deal. And like according to CoStar, that market cap was 6.5, right? So what are you going to do? Tell investors, hey, it's just going to be a 6 because I want it to be a 6? No, you can't do that. So yeah, that's how it went.
Yeah. I mean, there's two ways to make money in real estate. There's to add value or is to assume interest rates are going to go down.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The second doesn't sound good.
Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. So I think, you have a unique perspective. You kind of didn't take development and turn this on its head, but you have a unique perspective towards it. I think, what is one thing you got right throughout this whole process? And what's one thing where the old heads might've been right and maybe you got it wrong?
Oh, it'd be easier if you'd warn me with these questions.
This is a tough one. But I want to ask you because you can't be perfect.
Yeah. No, I think what we've gotten right is we opened our first site in Vegas, and we had a view that if we built next to where there are really high rates and really old supply, that it would do well. And what we found is that we're getting a ton more demand than I thought we were going to get at this point. So like the thesis of like focusing on rate for us, makes a lot of sense. And I think has played out in the facilities we've seen in the performance wise. Now we've only been open since October. So it's like, I can't take, that's not a victory lap, because until you get to stabilize across a whole plethora of sites that we've built, can you really, you know, declare victory on how smart you are. I think what I was warned about is the problems that you'd have scaling. I wouldn't say that necessarily the old guard was right, but it's that's definitely the most difficult part about what we're doing is like, all right, we're building 10 a year. In thinking about going to 20, you know, that's tough. It's been the toughest thing for us to do is to really scale that. We're finding ways, but you know, obviously, you know, we're in a cycle right now where we're trying to find that amount of debt and that amount of equity. I mean, the equity is actually not as difficult. It's just the debt and structuring it around having the operational capacity to do that. I'd say, you know, we were warned about how difficult it'd be to scale at this, you know, the scale we are trying to achieve. And I'd say that's continued to be, you know, one of the more difficult things that we're trying to achieve, which is, you know, just trying to do what we're doing at the numbers we're trying to do them at, which is, you know, I don't know, 20, 25 developments a year, which would be a lot of storage, but I think we could do it.
Mm-hmm. What's the long-term goal?
I mean, there's a lot of different ways this could go, but like the one that I hold, you know, closest is that I to the extent I, yeah, we have to do what's in the best interest of our investors, but to the extent that I can continue to match those expectations on the exit and buy those assets into a, another fund and continue to scale a portfolio, I'd love to continue to hold on to these locations, to these assets in different vehicles going forward, because I don't want to be a merchant developer. And ultimately, you know, do we want to run our own brand? Maybe. I mean, there's a whole other headache that I haven't even dealt with at this point. You know, it's a whole different problem we'd be solving. With what we're doing on the managed space side and the software side, like, I think we'd have a pretty interesting angle at coming at that and doing that. But, you know, running our own brand would be really cool, but, you know, it'd be a whole other company we'd be starting.
Yeah. It's a totally different business. Yeah.
Totally different business. Yeah. But, you know, the experience in storage is pretty crummy, quite honestly, I think. And I was actually, I was shocked. I lost my key to my unit. I have a storage facility. I have a storage unit. I originally got it to test one of our third-party managers and their pricing strategy, just to say, like, okay, I'd been in there while we were building ours. Like, I rented it on a vacant or brand new build, and just to see like how they raised my rents and did everything else. And then it turned into like, all right, now I have all my shit in there, so I can't move it out. So I'm actually now actually using a self-storage unit, but I lost my key, which is my fault. But what a shitty experience, to where it's like, now I got to go find a locksmith to drill out this lock. I don't think like the Janus installing a full lock on there makes any sense. I think like some sort of lock with a Bluetooth component on it makes sense. But like the infrastructure for all this stuff has not been thought through, because like PTI has got this lock, but you have to have your separate app. It's like, you're not going to have a fucking public storage app and then a separate PTI lock app. And like, no one's thought through the stack of like how this actually functions. So I do think that there's continuing to be a lot of opportunity if you go on the operational side and think about it from the experience. Like, there's just been so many guys that have made so much money that haven't had to think about the experience in storage, that I do think that there's an element of that where there can be a lot of opportunity.
You're calling like public storage is the mom and pop operator. that's kind of what you're saying. It is interesting.
Well, I mean, listen, they're a real estate company. They're not a technology company.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm agreeing with you. I'm just calling it out.
Like, one of my best friends works at Extra Space. I love him to death, but as much as they tout themselves as being a technology company, like, when you actually realize like how new tech gets implemented and developed and the incentives that the people are doing it actually have, and if they're just a cog in a larger company, it doesn't necessarily always work out with the same velocity and efficacy as if like it's your company, you're not a public company, and you're thinking through this problem holistically and you're trying to solve it in that route. And so I do think that while the publics are doing, you know, public storage, Extra Space, they're doing a generally good job, they're only doing 70% of where you could go, because it's like, you know, at the end of the day, most of those employees go home, they're checking the box, they're getting it done pretty well. But it's like, at this point, they're making, you know, Extra Spaces how many billions of NOI a year, like changing the dynamic of storage from their standpoint is not going to move the needle.
Yeah. I'd be conservative if I were them too. You know?
Yeah. Like, it's broken. Don't fix it. Which is great for, you know, entrance on our side, which is that if you can actually create a different experience, there's something pretty cool you could do there. Now, you're talking about creating a brand and an experience in what is, I've told people, is a pure commodity market. So the hurdle is enormous, mm-hmm. right? Because how are you effectively going to give people an incentive or drive them enough to where they're interested in not only using self-storage, but like finding your brand? That's a high hurdle.
Yeah. How do you overcome the geography moat, right? Like the distance to the facility, you know, you have like a drone self-driving car, pick up someone's shit. I don't know. Like, but that is the biggest problem.
Yeah.
Like that is the issue.
Presumably it'd be like, you know, when the experience of using your product is understood by the market, then that market is going to prefer your product over other people.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that if your product doesn't exist in another market, they're obviously going to use the other product. But yeah, I play around with that. It comes down to, you know, do I want to spend 30 years perfecting storage? Like, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. There's other stuff out there.
I've been doing storage for 8 years. I'm going to be doing it definitely in the near and medium term. Am I going to be 60-year-old solving storage problems? I'm not. I'm humble enough to understand with where I thought I would be 10 years ago and where I am today, and understanding that I have no idea where I'm going to be in 15 years. So we'll say, you know, there are problems that we can continue to solve. Whether we're going to solve all of them, I'm not sure.
Very cool. Very cool. Corey, it was awesome listening to your story. Super, super interesting. Before I forget, I want to make sure people know where to find you. So if one of our viewers wants to follow you along, where do they go?
We didn't even talk about the social. The last 3 or 4 months, I've gotten into the Twitter game, which is how I met you guys.
Yeah.
The handle is Storage Data Dev. And I'm on LinkedIn as well. But yeah, trying to post some content about what's going on in storage, and find me there. You can go to dxd.capital if you want to learn more about DXD. And then there's always Radius Plus, RadiusPlus.com. And yeah, boys, thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Corey. And we'll see you guys next week. Peace.